Hey, everybody. How are you? Welcome to the Other People Show. My name is Brad Listy. It's nice to be with you. I'm here in Los Angeles, and I have Andrea Baiani on the program today. He is an Italian writer. His new novel is called If You Kept a Record of Sins. It is available in translation from Archipelago Books. It was translated from the Italian by Elizabeth Harris. It's a wonderful book. It's a wonderful novel, and it's a wonderful translation. So great to meet Andrea and to learn more about his book, its origin stories, why he wrote it, how he wrote it, and so on and so forth. That conversation is coming up. I do, before we get started, want to say just a few brief words about the historical moment that we're in. As I record this on April 20th, 2021, we're just a couple of hours removed from the announcement of the verdict in the George Floyd trial. Derek Chauvin, the police officer who murdered George Floyd in cold blood on camera, has been convicted on all counts, cuffed and taken to jail. So it's a moment for like enormous relief, some celebration that justice has been done in this instance. There's been accountability. I know everybody's parsing the way that you're supposed to talk about this, but hopefully you know what I mean. And, you know, there are a million things to talk about, but what keeps coming to mind for me is this young girl, Darnella Frazier, the 17-year-old girl who filmed the murder with her smartphone. And without this footage, we likely would not be here today with guilty verdicts on all three counts. I think about being 17 years old and having the courage to stand there at close range with like a hostile police officer filming, and to have the courage to simply bear witness to something so hardcore. This young girl. And I'm sure it traumatized her. I'm sure she'll be living with it for the rest of her life. But I can't escape the idea that what she did, you know, could potentially be at the heart of some great change. I guess what I'm saying is that I think it brought home to me the importance of bearing witness, of showing up, and the importance of having courage in important moments. Not looking away, not walking away. But bearing witness, believing your own eyes, and saying what 17-year-old Darnella Frazier said in the aftermath. She said, quote, "It wasn't right. This is a kid." It doesn't get much simpler than that. Anybody who watches that tape, who has, you know, a reasonably functional soul, knows that what happened to George Floyd was not right. So today and tonight, Derek Chauvin is in a prison cell where he belongs. And, you know, for at least this moment, we can feel good about the fact that there has been some accountability. More to do, obviously, but there's been accountability. And I shudder to think what would have happened had there not been, you know? So, anyway, a good day in a lot of ways. Today's episode is brought to you by Avid Reader Press, publisher of Infinite Country. It's a new novel by Patricia Engel. This is an excellent book. It is rich with Bogota urban life. It is steeped in Andean myth. And it is tense with the reality of what it means to be undocumented in the United States of America. Infinite Country is the story of two countries and one mixed status family. It's a book that asks readers if home can be a country that you've never known. This is a Reese Witherspoon Book Club selection and an instant New York Times bestseller. Infinite Country by Patricia Engel, available now in bookstores and online from Avid Reader Press. So my guest today is Andrea Baiani. His new novel, If You Kept a Record of Sins, is available in translation from the Italian from Archipelago Books. Such a pleasure to meet him and to get to share this conversation with you. This is an excellent novel. So here he is, folks. This is Andrea Baiani, and his novel, one more time, is called If You Kept a Record of Sins.
So in 2001, basically what happened was that my grandma died. So she died. We were at the time living in the north of Italy, whereas she was living in Rome, where I was born and where we used to live before moving to the north, to the Alps. At that point, I was just writing short stories. I didn't even write the first novel. And all the things I was writing were just funny things, kind of comic, brilliant, very smart things. You want to show the phase in which you want to show how smart you are when you write. And you want everybody to feel it immediately, now that every phrase has to say, oh my God, how great is this guy? So I was in that phase when my grandma died. And what happened was that I just went, I remember very, very, very clearly that I just took a train, a night train from the Alps to Rome, just to go to her funeral. And then I spent the day there in Rome. I didn't even spend the night. I took the last train out the night from Rome and slept in the over the train and got to the Alps the following day, very early in the morning. And what happened is that after these 36 hours, basically not sleeping, and with the reality coming so strongly, kicking so hard, it was not only death, was a funeral, was a family, a dysfunctional family that in front of a funeral was even more dysfunctional, and an Italian dysfunctional family can be a lot. And so after that, after this, I don't know, this experience, I would say that it was just a hard experience. I just wrote down a piece that was basically 2-3 pages addressing to her, to my grandma, or to what I saw at the time at that funeral. And it was amazing. Because the kind of writing it appeared on my screen was completely different. I was not anymore the brilliant comic super, hey, you are the best. I was just someone going straight forward. So basically, life hit me in a way and said to me, hey, if you want to say, to write about me, life and death, you had to look at me and look into my eyes. It's not that it's not a carnival. It's something serious. So I wrote these two pages like that. So there were just 2-3 pages of a funeral. And then I said, oh my God, can I write that way? And it was not, oh my God, saying how good it is. It's just that it was kind of a revelation at that time. I was 25, I don't know. But then basically, it was 5 or 6 years before the novel. And for the following 5 or 6 years, I basically tried to find the place where to put these 2 or 3 pages I wrote at the funeral, after the funeral of my grandma. So I was, you know, like the Cinderella, like when there's the shoe that the prince has to find the right foot, and then Cinderella fits her foot, fits the shoe, and then there's a marriage. So basically, I've been looking for the story, for the foot, or for the more, I would say, for the shoe, to fit in that foot, that piece of writing that I wrote at that time. So basically, what happened was at a certain time that it was kind of leaves growing around the tree. So basically, this first writing that was came from reality, from my personal life, and around that, in these 4 or 5 years, there were these leaves growing without even, I was not even aware about that. Just that at a certain point, I started realizing that there was a story around that, that in 5 years, what was personal stayed personal in the sense of emotions, but became a story, was not a grandma, was a mother. And so I was realizing that there was a, basically after this story I wrote, there was something that was basically a mystery of someone disappearing, and how mysterious can be for the son I was. At the time I was a grandson, but the boy I was, even if I was 25, but in front of someone who dies, even if you are 45, you are a little boy, because it's so bigger than you that you are so small. So I started taking notes about this mother leaving, so about a woman that disappears. And at that point, I started researching on another field that was not connected to the emotional story of a relationship between a mother and a son, that was Italian entrepreneurs going to the East Europe, former Soviet Europe, to make business and so on. And so it took a while. I traveled a lot between Italy and Romania to research, because I was interested in that, but was a, I don't know, it was a question I had in my mind. And so I said, I was interested, and I didn't even know at the time that the two stories, meaning a mother leaving and the son waiting, and Italian entrepreneurs going to Romania for business, would have become the same story. I was just following myself. I was just chasing the questions I had in my mind. And then at a certain point, in a mysterious way, you know, stories become stories, they glued, they melted, and they became one tier, I would say, one little river. And at that moment, so after 5-6 years from the first page written without knowing that this was this novel, a year traveling between Italy and Romania, and lots of notebooks full of notes about a story I didn't know. I was writing from that moment, that moment on. It's true that it was a very fast novel. Right. I wrote it down in 7 months.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's great to hear, like, because I think sometimes people who are working and slogging away on a book can read something or read about a book that came out quickly, and they might not get all the backstory. They might not realize that the incubation period was a number of years, you know, that without which the writing would never have been able to happen at all. And
yeah, and sometimes that's the interesting thing also for the one who writes, is that many times you are not even aware of that. I mean, it's just someone kicking or knocking on your door, but it's too far away in your stomach to be heard. And so at a certain point, maybe you don't even know. Now I know, I have traces, so I could tell you the story of the background. But sometimes maybe you don't know that was incubating, but it was incubating.
So your novel is about, as you said, it's about a son whose mother has died. This is not a comedy. it's a sad story, but it's a gripping story. And, you know, it's a mystery. That word is so crucial. You just said it, and it really made a light bulb kind of go off in my mind, because I guess one of the, you know, it's a lesson. You know, when we lose someone, like you lose a grandparent, I think in particular, when there's a generational divide between you and the person who's left, there is so much that you don't know. Even if you know the person well, to lose someone creates a mystery, always. And the drama of your novel is in that divide between mother and son. The son who has not seen his mother in a long time, who lost touch with her. She sort of abandoned the family, essentially, and moved to Romania. He's in Romania for her funeral and is picking up clues, essentially, you know, whether he likes it or not.
It's true. And yeah, and moreover, you're right that when someone disappears, when someone passes away, it's always like that. It's always a mystery. And moreover, if you see the body, and then there's the mystery of, also the mystery of the first death, death you are spectator of, or you are in front of the first dead body you see. In this case, or in my story, was not dead, the first one. But in general, there's a, even if that's the point, even if, as I was saying, even if you are a grown up, it's the first time that you are in front of something that is so incredibly unbelievable. Even if you are a grown up, you could even be an engineer, or I mean a scientist, I don't know, an engineer in constructions and something very solid. But still, when someone dies, you ask yourself the same question a little boy or a little girl can ask her or his parents, that is, where did he go?
Right.
Where did she go?
Right.
Now, that's the point. No, of course, it's the he or she is there, the dead one, but you wonder that, no? And so that's always a mystery, of course. In this case, then there's a relationship son and mother, no, in the case of the novel. And you know, when I don't know, pediatricians and so on, they always say, and if you read whatever you read, you know that in the first phase, months, year and a half, a son doesn't understand that there's a difference between him or her and their mom, meaning that when they say I, they think that the mother and the son, in this case, let's talk about the son of the book, that they are the same thing. So saying I is, you don't know where your body ends and your mother's one starts, no, begins. And it's like that you live 9 months in the belly and so on. And the only you that you know is your dad. Is your father. So the you is only the father, because you are supposed to, in Italy even more, because we are the mommy country. But in general, I would say that you are, as a son, the son is the mother, and the mother is the son. And that's why at a certain point, that's why this book is a book, is a novel written in a way to the second person. So it's not a letter, but it's him addressing to her now after her death, because it's even more unbelievable. There's also the mystery of every son that has to accept, who has to accept that the mother is not I, is a you, is someone else. So
yes.
In general, the mother is always a mystery. That's why children are always more annoyed by the mother than by the father, because they can't really understand why it's not always there, why there's a difference between the two of them. And in this case, there's also a bigger mystery, because and that's why the book is told in two ways. So the book is the novel is told putting together, alternating in a way, moments from the past when the mother and the son, that was a little boy and then a teenager, the beginning of his teenagerhood, where they are two, but it's basically they live in an island that is a very also fun island where they play. There's love, there's warmth, there's everything is kind of playful in a way, and it's and then in something in a relationship that is already always complicated like that, but then there's what you were saying, that then she leaves and then she actually in fact abandons him together with the stepfather, not even with his father, and so what he tries to do, so it's not a crime novel at all, but in a way it's a crime novel, because he tries to put together the two halves of a woman. The first half is the mother, the playful, loving, and blah, 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 mother. And the second one is the opposite, someone who left and what happened and left to go to a better place. And what's this better place? Then he will travel and we'll talk about it. But so it's like, it's true that it's he's looking for clues. He's looking for clues, and the paradoxical thing in a way, it's looking for clues about the person that is the one he knows the most.
Right.
The best.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, when we talk about parental abandonment, I think in general, it's usually the father who bails. At least, you know, I think that statistically would bear out. And I found in reading your book something extra heartbreaking about this guy, this narrator, losing his mom. To have your mom bail and to leave country and to sort of check out, just a heartbreaking sense of loss on his part. And I also felt, and this is to your credit, I felt a lot of sympathy for the mother who did the abandoning. The complexity of her life and her desires, like you said, you know, there's the challenge that children have in recognizing and coming to terms with the fact that their mother is an individual who has concerns and desires and fears and hopes and dreams that are entirely separate from them. You know, she has a complicated life. She gets pregnant out of wedlock, has this baby against her family's wishes, so, you know, creates a rupture with her own parents. So there's that dysfunction that she's dealing with. And then she's in so many ways, she's a great mother. She's very present for her child. They have, like you said, a warm relationship. But at a certain point in her life, you know, other people and other interests and desires intercede. And she winds up leaving. But I never... As much as I hate that decision, and as much as I, you know, can't even imagine leaving my kids, you know, as a parent, it's like, how could you do that? I do understand her as a human being. And I'm glad you portrayed her that way, because I think in the absence of it, if she was just some kind of two-dimensional villain, or if the main character, if the protagonist had that sort of view of her, it would have, I think it would have been a lesser book. You needed her humanity in order to accentuate the tragedy of it.
Yeah, and you know, the point for me was, yeah, probably I myself needed to have these two halves, not to be judgmental, meaning that the point is, I don't know if we could call it empathy, understanding. I don't know what it is, but for sure there is something that is, and that basically the way in which I wrote it, that's something that is always so human. For me, that's the point. I mean, the real point, and I guess that's, yeah, my goal. I don't know, but it's the posture I have when I write. It's to look for what the portion of humanity. It doesn't mean that I'm looking for forgiveness. That's not the point. But if you kept a record of sins, means that, no? That if you just kept a record of sins, I mean, come on. There's no one that can be saved, no? Can be saved by anyone else. So basically, she's a mother, meaning she's not only a mother, she's a woman, in a society in which basically only men are allowed to look for success or for to look for happiness in their work field, and a woman is supposed just to be to be a good mother, and whereas what she does is very human. So what she does basically, she falls in love first, and that's, I guess, the most human thing it can happen in your life. I wish everybody could fall in love, can fall in love at least one time in life. And she falls in love, and then she wants to affirm herself. She wants to say, I'm worth it. And that's the point. Then, of course, everything becomes much more complicated, because then, of course, then you have a son, and then your former husband, blah, blah, blah. And then the father of this son you had left you just after the baby was born, and lots of other things. But basically, there's something that is completely human. And there's something that, of course, a son can't understand, and maybe doesn't have to understand. That's not the point of saying, oh, she's like that, so he shouldn't. No, that's not the point, because it's also very human not understanding. It's also very human to hate. It's also very human being aggressive and being whatever it is and whatever you want to be. So for me, this is a book full of human people that some of them are portrayed as assholes. I mean, there are also some of the entrepreneur, Italian entrepreneurs going to Romania and being just with this patronizing posture, and they want to be powerful, and they want to have all the young women, and the kind of, no, it's kind of a colonial attitude, and so on and so forth. But also, these people are just kind of losers in their previous life who try to have a better life. I mean, they are assholes, but and that's not the point. It's I'm not a judge. I'm not in literature doesn't have to be that. I think it's just the place where you can feel humanity in all the contradictions being human means. And so that was the point. And the point when I wrote it, now I know, I think I know what I wrote. But at the time, I was just I started, I don't know, it was just, I had just lots of human losers looking for a better life in their lives, some of them were terrible, some of them were less terrible, and also, you know, Lula, that is the name of the mother of Lorenzo, that is the son telling the story, addressing her business is to try to sell this crazy funny big egg that it's to lose weight. So she has this this weird market.
Okay, but I want to stop, because like this, you know, you talk about her ambition and how, you know, in the culture that she, came of age in and in the world, essentially, that you know, writ large, that women are living in. A woman with ambition, you know, it can be a tough road to hoe. And
yeah,
she has some real brilliance to her. Even if this weight loss egg, which is her business, you sit inside of this egg, and it helps you lose weight, is a little bit crazy. Like, I sensed a real like brilliance to her in terms of what. Maybe not at the level of execution, but certainly at the level of potential. It was kind of a woman, I feel like, who in different circumstances could be a great success. Is that a misreading? And then, like, as an addendum to that, I would also say that, you know, all of this talk about Italians going into post-Soviet bloc countries to seek reinvention, I see a nice bit of symbolism that there's a woman out there trying to sell a giant egg.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. I think that there's, in a way, in as far as I understand of this character, of this person, I think that she's in a way. She could be, you are right, she could be a real genius in a way, because she's completely naive. So it's kind of a mixture between something that is completely capitalistic, no? The idea of going there, and so you can pay less and blah, blah, and all the things we know about Western countries going there to explode and so on and so forth, but in a way there's if she has wings, and her wings are just naive. She goes for love and she goes to sell an egg. I mean, it's a. I mean, it's she goes and tries to sell an egg in a place where people were just starving. I mean, it's not that she goes and tries to sell an egg in a place where, I mean, there are only people who need to lose weight. But still, in a way, she's a genius, because she basically she's a genius in the sense that at the same time she. She tries to be as capitalistic as she can, and at the same time, she's very critical of capitalism. So basically, she goes there together with the symbol of the worst of the Western world, meaning both being overweight and being obsessed with being thin. Or in a very good shape. I think she can't be successful. And this is something that I have to say, just because I love her, but as a person or as a character, I don't know. But I mean, we bonded in the time I wrote the novel. But she couldn't be successful because basically she's not mean. And that's, I know that is judgmental, what I'm saying, but I'm saying as Andrea, not as Lorenzo. It's not a judgment that you can find in the novel. She's a genius who couldn't be successful because you have to be a little bit mean to survive. She goes into the jungle, bringing a couple of flowers and an egg. And I mean, how you can survive. And the problem is that she, since a son, so going back to the fact that the novel, the center of the novel is Lorenzo, is the son addressing to her, then the center of the novel, for sure, the one who writes, the narrator, is Lorenzo. And the son always believes what the mother says. And that's the real drama, in a way, of the book, meaning that a son believes that if a mother says, I'll be right back, she'll be back, and she's back. And if she doesn't come back, but she says, oh, I'm in an incredible place, this is heaven, and the son believes that. So that the story of the book is also him as a boy or teenager believing when she calls from Romania saying, oh, it's wonderful here. It's like the Far West. I mean, it's incredible. And he is just a son talking to his mom on the phone, and he can't but believe her. And the drama and the, in a way, the tragic side of the novel is that then he has to realize that she was not living in heaven. That was not the paradise where she was, and that she was unhappy. And there, but she couldn't say, "I'm unhappy," because a mother is a magician, and so she can't say, "I couldn't succeed."
Well, yeah, I mean, this feels very familiar to me as an American, and maybe especially so as a Los Angelino. People can never admit that they're struggling. Yeah. Everyone's always great. I'm sure you've noticed this as an Italian living in the States. Like,
yeah, also because we always complain. We are the opposite side. Oh my God, today, I have a head. We are very dramatic.
I mean, I just feel like sometimes I'll have a conversation with a friend, and especially around matters pertaining to business and success, it's like this pathology. You can never just say like, hey, things are shitty. You know, it's always got to be like, things are great. We're rolling. We're crushing it. And it's like, really? Are you? I don't believe you. and it just seems sad to me. And, you know, I got to say.
But at the same time, sorry, then just one. But at the same time, there's something that is so, in a way, tender in this being so ridiculous. There's also a very human side, because it's so ridiculous to say, how's it going? Oh, it's great. And then, I don't know, his face or her face is so completely sad and pale. And in the space that is between his or her being pale and they're saying, it's great, there's something that is at the same time ridiculous and moving.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, we were talking about the genius of Lula, this mother character. And like, I think there's an admiration that I have for entrepreneurs. I would call an artist an entrepreneur, because anybody who's kind of trying to build their own thing, it takes a level of self-belief and almost like willful naivete. Like, you almost have to shut out all doubt, and you have to be you have to be willing to leap. And I always have great admiration for people who are able to do that, because you have to deal with so much rejection. You have to deal with so much doubt and difficulty. And to maintain one's energy and optimism and maybe deluded self-belief or whatever it is you need to keep yourself going, I find that heartbreaking and winning at the same time. I always cheer for people like that.
Yeah, yeah. And in this case was just a little background, but it's so when I was researching, so at the beginning I didn't know exactly when I was taking my notes, so I knew that she was going there that for business. I knew that she had to sell something, but I didn't know exactly what. And again, you know, it's just always by chance. So a friend of mine sent me a link to a thing, and was kind of was not an egg, but the way I misread the image I saw was, what's that? It's kind of a gigantic egg. It was something else. Was a gigantic box. But the function was the same, to make people lose weight. But the fact that I misread it and I thought that it was, that could be interesting. And at the time, what I did, it's so funny, because I taught to lots of people who sold different would sell different kind of machines to lose weight. I never really found an egg, so I had to invent it. But
I want to stop you. I actually Googled weight loss egg. I wanted to know if this was real. I was like,
could you find it?
No.
I don't think it exists. It's just was my miss seeing something, an image. So I went to different places because I wanted to understand how it works. Because I mean, as a novelist, unless it's something that you really know because you work in it or it's your life or whatever. But if you put together things that are true with things that are not real and so on. So I had to research a lot. So I remember this going to a place. There was just a gigantic box, but you didn't enter the box. There were just cables and so I said, so what how does it work? And I remember that it was a friend of a friend of a friend who opened the company, the place, just on Saturday morning, and there was no one. There was no one working there. There was just the secretary there. And so he said, so would you like to see how it works? And he said, do you want me to try your new? And then at the time I was kind of very thin, and he told me, but I really don't enjoy it. You are too thin, so I want someone more. And so at that point was everything became so crazy. So he asked this woman, was in her 50s, saying, oh, come on, come here. And so put the cables on the body of this secretary that was all of a sudden in her bras. And I mean, was completely crazy. I was completely astonished looking at this situation. And so, I mean, it's a crazy world, but it was interesting. It's always interesting to research these kind of things, but it was very interesting to try to really think of this obsession that we have in Western world for becoming the Photoshop version of ourselves also in 3D life.
Yes, absolutely. And I got to say, you know, the fact that I Googled it means that I bought it. Like, it was real enough to me on the page that I was like, this could be real. And the world is absurd enough that, like, a weight loss egg is not outside the realm of possibility. So I want to ask you, because we've been talking about this, and my understanding of, you know, Italian history, Italian culture, European history, European culture is not probably as astute as yours, is this notion of Europeans, or maybe it was especially Italian entrepreneurs, going into post-Soviet bloc countries to seek a new life and to seek renewal and to try their hand at business in a place where the exchange rate was better or whatever it happens to be. This was a real, this happened widely. Like, I guess I haven't read much about this.
Yeah, it's just that it happened a lot and still happens. Now I guess they are more moving towards the far east, more far than the former Soviet countries, the former Soviet bloc, as you were saying correctly, and in a way it happened a lot. It happened at the beginning of the 90s was the very beginning, just after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and then with 91, with the end of Soviet Union in Russia, and yeah, became and in a way it was just something that was very wide, was very and was at the same time, you know, is this kind of mixture of capitalism being ferocious and very creative, no? That's the point of capitalism, being so cynical, being so violent, but at the same time always looking for ideas. No, so Europeans from all, not only Italians, but then there was something that was very interesting because every European country tried to find a country in the former Soviet bloc that was in a way close to them for culture, language. And so Romania and Italian are kind of similar also in terms of language. There's a Latin root, and so it's easy to understand. And so, you know, Italy was a former poor country. And so Italy got to capitalism only in the 60s. I mean, till the end of World War II, we were just people with farmers with goats and cows and tomatoes and other and vegetables and mozzarella and these other kind of wonderful things. I miss them a lot from here, I have to say.
I was going to say, it sounds great. Sign me up.
Yeah. And then it happened this violent and enthusiastic in the way it was lived. A conversion into a capitalistic country, and when something happens so fast, in a way you are never really sure you did the right thing. I mean, it is as if you become something else, and everybody is saying that this something else you became is the best thing, no? But you are not really sure, because it's like flying instead of driving, that you land somewhere, but there's the time zone and you are not exactly sure what happened. And so your body is still missing all the ground it didn't drive. And so it's kind of shocking. So Italy in the 60s and in the 70s was kind of a shocked country, trying to believe that capitalism was the way, the right way, the successful way, and that being all dressed up the same way, watching all together the same TVs and so on and so forth was the right thing. So basically, I think that, of course, the thing that happened at the beginning of the 90s, the real development of the business was just in 2000 or in late 90s and beginning of the 2000, was that in a way, of course, there was business, but there was also a way of trying to convince ourselves as Italians that we did the right choice. So to try to export a system we were not really very good at, and we are not very good at
right
now. And so I guess in this thing, and we had the biggest Communist Party in Europe as Italians. So in a way was to say, okay, we did the right thing, and then was a disaster.
I mean, yeah, it's like you're speaking my language. I have so many reservations, especially, I mean, coming in, you know, growing up in the United States, capitalism is presented as sort of like a terminus, which I always bristle at. It's like, okay, we've arrived. This is the best way. It's been decided. It's sort of presented to you that way, like you've hit the finish line. And I don't view life that way. I mean, I don't think we've – it certainly doesn't seem like we've sorted it out and we've landed on the best system. I think, like, things have – it seems to me things have gotten tilted way out of balance. And
there's a – in a way, there's a structure in the U.S. It's kind of – the spine is like that. I mean, it's looking for – you know, trying to discover new things, new territories, and new Italy is just sitting down with a chair next to your door. That's the point. And all of a sudden, everyone has to become a businessman. People who basically are not able to sell anything. That's not true, because I know all the brands, Italian brands, but basically that's the point. And there's the shock between being a southern place where you are just expect to be happy and eat and a little bit fat, fat in the sense that you have to look a little bit overweight, and the idea of overweight is that you are good, that you are living the right way, and all of a sudden becoming a country in which you have to be thin. No, that's a contradiction.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's. I guess, like, I feel like some of those old world ways that have been lost, it's a tragedy, because I often feel like I'm bad at capitalism. I make that as a joke, but I'm not entirely unserious when I say it. I can often look out at the world and wonder, like, how many people are actually good at this to begin with? It doesn't seem like very many people are. And there are some people who take to that system very well and easily, and it's like, you know, round peg into a round hole. But for so many people, it's a huge struggle. I think a lot of people who wind up in literature, it's a huge struggle. It's not necessarily a supernatural fit for me to go out and to try to sell things to people or to compete in the marketplace and crush the competition. Like, all of that is anathema to me. I'm kind of like, I just want to sit by my door and, you know.
Yeah, and you know, the difference, the struggle is, yeah, is a key word, I think. But for instance, if I think in terms of attitude, the difference between, for instance, being in New York or being in Rome, in New York, people are basically on time because there's no time. And so you don't have to waste time, no, because you have to do things, do blah, blah. In Rome, they are always late. So it's hard to sell anything if you are not there at the same moment as your client.
Right.
And but then, yeah, it's a big topic, of course.
Oh, and I feel like, yeah, it's a big topic. I feel like there's got to be, like, the clearest that I can get about it is that there's got to be some sort of equilibrium between the two, like, polarities, between, like, the more communal or communitarian impulse and the capitalistic impulse. And I don't know where that sweet spot is. I don't know if anybody does, but it seems.
Yeah, but the problem is that, as far as I understood of being alive, is that equilibrium is something you get for 1, 2, 3 seconds and then stop.
Right.
That's nature that doesn't work like that.
So let me ask you, because, like, you know, this is a related question. It's like, you know, the research that you were doing about the Lula character going to Romania, it was experiential research. You got on a plane, I'm assuming, and you flew to Bucharest. Yeah. So just, like, can you talk a little bit about how many trips did you take? What was your on the ground experience like, and how did that inform the writing of the book?
Yeah, I always liked this part of writing books, because it's writing, even if you are just entering, going in an airport at the gate, I'm still writing. Doing that, I'm writing with my body notes for what I'm gonna write. And it's something that I don't think necessarily you have to do, but it's a way for me to focus. In a way, it's also fun. So it's also a way. Sometimes I'm glad. No, many times I'm glad that my job is this. But I'm glad because sometimes I also find the story I want to leave also. Not only that I want to write, meaning that I say, oh, it's not that I say, oh, I want to go to, to Japan, so I'm going to write. It's not like that. I'm going to write about Japan. But still, when I start the story, the research side is very exciting. And in a way, for me, it's just that as a writer, going through a book, so from the very first moment, in this case, as we were describing, I was describing at the very beginning, in basically 5 years or 6 years, and then 8 months writing. But if there's no evolution in me, in myself, going through a book, making before writing, and then writing the book, it means that it was not worth it. if I'm the same person, if the one that starts working on a novel and the one who gets out of the last phrase of a novel is the same, it's a failure. Meaning there's no trip, I didn't evolve, there's no evolution in terms of knowledge or in terms of humanity, of myself or whatever. You understand what I'm saying, but going really physically through something, experiencing, it's not sometimes only experiencing in terms of, so I'm going to go to Romania, I'm going to take notes of what I see. So there are 5 cars at the airport and people are behaving like that. Because I'm also very distracted as a person. I'm a very emotional guy, meaning that I'm very brave, and at the same time I'm so completely full of fears. I'm very brave in the sense that I can't but do something if I'm too curious, but shaking maybe because the curiosity is much stronger than me, and so I say I have to say to my curiosity, so stop, I'm not brave enough to go there. Come, no, I don't want, I'm scared, blah blah blah. And so basically, I live. I started traveling to Romania was just by chance, like everything. So it happened that a friend of mine in Italy told me, you know, I didn't know anything about her. We were working together on a project and just drinking a glass of wine. She said, you know, finally tomorrow I'm gonna see my mother after, I don't know, 3 years, 4 years, or whatever. And I said, oh, so what happened? And she said, oh, you know, she works in Romania because she's the manager of a company. They produce shoes, Italian shoes produced in Romania, in the north of Romania. And I said, what? And at the time, I didn't know exactly what. Yeah, of course, I knew what Romania was. I knew Ceausescu. I knew the history and so whatever. But if you had told me at the time, so now, can you please draw a map of Europe, a plan of Europe, and tell me where Romania is? I would have put it in the wrong place. I was not sure. But at the same time, when drinking this glass of wine, she told me that, I don't know what happened, and I thought, oh, that's interesting. And I didn't think that's interesting for a story. It was just that there was probably the little boy in me saying, let's go there. No, yeah. That's the main point. So basically, the beginning was that. And that is the moment in which I started thinking little by little, at the beginning, probably not so completely aware, and then more conscious as what I was doing, that this woman, this mother of a friend of mine kind of woman, and the mother I was trying to describe in the notes about the relationship between the mother and the son were the same or could have been the same person. At the time I thought, I'm really animal as a writer, so I'm really going by instinct. And so I said, oh, wow, can I be in touch with your mom? And so I talked to her mom, and so, and blah, blah. So the beginning of research was that, and I got in touch with the Italian entrepreneurs that were not connected to the shoe company of her mom, but were other people. And so I got a few phone numbers, and what I did was just that I bought a ticket from Torino at the time, the Alps, and Bucharest. That's what I did, the first trip. And my idea at the very beginning was just that I wanted to write, or I wanted to look for stories connected to big companies. So my idea was kind of a stereotypical idea of big companies in the Eastern world, full of 1 billion little workers working 24 hours a day for nothing, for 1 cent. That was my stereotypical or journalistic, that this was what I was reading on the papers, on TV and so on. So the beginning was that. So I landed to Bucharest, and I was there. And the first interview or the first contact I had was with someone, a manager in an Italian company. I don't even remember what they were producing, but they were gigantic. And they were so incredibly nice. They gave me a room or even an apartment. They gave me a chauffeur, a kind of a driver.
Wow.
That then became kind of the model for Christian, that is the driver of Lula in the U.S. So they were really excited also, because they thought, oh, maybe this can be good for us as a advertisement. There's the writer coming here, he's going to write something, and we're going to become famous, or I mean, it's a way of communicating your enterprise and your company. So then in Bucharest was basically a disaster, because I started from a stereotype, and the only thing I could find was stereotypical. So I was just bored, and then I wanted to understand immediately. So my point was, I have to understand what's happening. And it's something that is so long that you can't understand in 5 minutes. Then Bucharest was a disaster also, because one day at the train station, a guy stole all my suitcases. So it was just a disaster from every point of view. But still, I was so completely shocked and completely in love with that place. I immediately fell in love, because Bucharest has at the same time the shape of an old Paris, ruined by building gigantic buildings during the communist time to bring people from the country to work in the city and so on. So it's a mixture of an old beauty then ruined, so there you can still, and it's very alive from a cultural now point of view and so on, but it was kind of shocking, because it's also a violent city. And so at that moment, this was the very first trip, a friend of mine called me from Italy, and I answered, I was in Romania. He said, what? What are you doing in Bucharest? And they said, I basically don't know, and they told the story. That friend of mine drinking a glass of wine, I said, so you are in Bucharest? Yes. So he told me that friends of friends were living in another, in the north of Romania, and they left, and they just were, they opened a little enterprise selling, I don't remember even what, fan for bathrooms or whatever. And he said, if you want to go there, I can give you the phone number. And so I started traveling to the north of Romania, and I got in touch with this word that was the opposite of the stereotypical idea that I had, where just a single man or two or three men, usually male people, they just had their leader enterprise, and they pretended to be very powerful and a little bit charming as Italians, selling lots of things, paying nothing their workers. But when, and maybe with the flag of a soccer team, of Juventus or Milan soccer team, just outside their the building of their leader enterprise in the middle of nowhere, really, with just maybe horses outside. At the same time, was very archaic in a way, and with these people coming there, trying to be the representatives of the spoken people of modernity, of contemporary life. And when I met these people, There were really some of them were terrible, some of them not. But these, I thought, oh, that's what I want to talk about. Mm. These people who try to have a new life. So this was the first trip. And then I went there. I would say I went back and forth for a year for sure. I would say 4 or 5 trips. Every time was 3 weeks or a little bit more, or 1 month. But basically, I spent lots of time with them, even if sometimes really there was nothing I could agree on, or even if sometimes they were lying to me about lots of things. But at the same time, I was researching. But then I was interested as a human being. I was kind of attracted by this life that was not my life, no? And even if something was terrible, I was interested in being there as a person, not necessarily as a writer at the moment. Then after that, I started writing. People became characters. But became characters not because necessarily I wanted them to be different from the ones I met, but because then when you write, you know, you go somewhere else, and it's not reality is something you use, and then words are the bosses of the field.
Yeah, I mean, I think like what you're saying to me is you're making a great case, and I think your book makes a great case for the maybe not the necessity, but certainly the value of experiential research, not only at the human level, like just as writers, we spend so much time in our office or in our room alone, staring at a computer or staring at a blank page. And to get out into the world and to engage with the world and to travel if you can, and to kind of just get your hands dirty. It's just such a valuable experience, even if it's, you know, you put the art off to the side. I think it does something for us at the level of just like human energy to get out and meet people and to take yourself out of your comfort zone. And I know that there are people who can write setting. They could write a setting that is completely removed from their sphere of knowledge simply by looking at pictures on Google or watching YouTube videos. But man, when I read your novel, a lot of it is in Romania, it feels very lived in. And the characters that you paint, the Romanian characters that you paint are just so vivid to me and believable. And I have a hard time thinking that you could have done that in the absence of this kind of experience.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I don't think it could have been possible, because basically when I was saying that at the beginning, I thought that this was also a way of making the book or of going through an experience. It's also because I know that you can understand me, but someone maybe can think it's just a crazy thing, and maybe it is. So we are just talking between two crazy people. But the idea that little by little, day by day, doing these kind of things, you build the novel, meaning that you yourself become your character. That's the point of me traveling. So traveling in this case, or doing other kind of experiences, it's not that I want to be accurate. For me, that's not the point. It's not the point that I want to write something that so people can say, oh, yeah, it's true. It's true. Bucharest, this street is exactly like that. That's not the point. The point is that I have also a very, I write with all of myself. That's the point of being different when I start writing and ending and at the end of the book. So I want to live an experience. I want to live a book. I want to really go through a book. And so I have to become the book. I have to become the narrator. So that's why then it's so tricky. Also with my students at Rice, we talk about what autofiction and memoirs. And for me, I don't know what to say because, meaning in as soon as I start becoming the narrator, how can I say if it's not me or if this is my, is this my life? Of course it's my life. I had a mother who lived to Romania. Not at all. But this is my, this is really what I experienced. I guess the takeoff, I was Andrea, and the landing in Bucharest, I was Lorenzo. I was the Carter because as soon, of course, I can understand it can sound crazy, but as soon as got off the plane, I was in. I was entering a novel, not looking for details. I was living, I was building with my own body the story that I was about to write, even if I didn't have clear what it was not evident at the time. What, but of course I was already in, and the thing is that probably as a writer I can write only what I experience. And so either can be my life or, but since my life is boring in general, so I need to have an extra life that I want to live in order to write about it.
I get that. I feel that a lot. And I think, you know, when you do that sort of thing, there are always happy accidents. You know, you can't plan for what you're going to learn when you go out and travel and you get on the ground and disorient yourself. And I think, like, just as an example, there's a lot of poetic resonance in my mind anyway, between Bucharest, which is kind of this city of a fallen empire, you know, this post-Soviet, post, and forgive me on the pronunciation, is it Ceausescu? Is that how you pronounce it?
Ceausescu, we say in Italy, but
yeah. You know, but the big palace plays a role in the novel, and, you know, this is a guy, Lorenzo, who's there for the funeral of his mother, trying to kind of solve this mystery. Set against that backdrop, I feel like is a nice, beautiful, happy accident of art, you know, that I can't help but believe that it adds something, you know, to the tragedy of the book and also to like this kind of exotic, there's something fun about travel, like inside of a story, even if it's for a sad reason, you know, like to see this guy flying into this country that is not his own. You know, as a reader, it takes you on that journey with him and you're on a path of discovery with him. Because he is, like you say, he's trying to unpack the mystery, but he's also meeting Christian. He's meeting all these different characters who peopled his mother's life in this part of her life that did not involve him. And so it functions as a travelogue in a way, too, which I always appreciate in fiction. So, I don't know.
And then there's the thing of basically of displacement, of, you know, of losing your equilibrium. That's the point. I mean, if we don't lose our, I mean, walking is exactly that, losing your equilibrium every step. Either you lose for 1 second your equilibrium or you don't go anywhere. So the only way to move forward is to run the risk to fall down. No, and that's why there are also so many travels in trips in literature. But generally speaking, it's the place where, I mean, you are the most sensitive. I mean, when you are, I would say, in danger, when you are more worried, when you are less at ease, all your senses are really alert. And so I lived in many in a few countries and in a few cities. I lived in Berlin, I lived in Paris, I lived in Amsterdam, I lived in Rome, and blah blah blah. Now I'm Houston, Texas, every time, and I'm not I traveled to so many countries, but I'm not I don't know, I'm not very good at doing that, meaning that I'm not a good traveler. I'm a disaster every time, meaning really I'm clumsy every single thing I do. And it's not that if I, since I traveled a lot now, I prefer, no, every time I start a new experience, my day is full of freaking out for something. Oh my God, I know, and the pin for that, and oh, I have to open a bank account, or I have to, everything is freaking out, and it's the way I work. Then after that, I laugh at myself. And that's, but that's very interesting, because when I'm scared or freaking, that's why I was saying that I'm not brave. I mean, my curiosity is braver than I am, because every time, in any case, I'm in danger, even if rarely was a real danger. I was rarely in serious danger that I thought, oh, I'm gonna die, but I'm gonna spend the night outside or whatever other stupid things. Exactly in that moment, that is moving from, as you were saying, the comfort zone, all my senses are really alert. So my eyes are looking around like crazy to see if there's someone, if there's a door, if there's a, and trying to also fear helps you in being hypersensitive, no? And so that's in a way also for Lorenzo as a character, as a narrator. He enters Romania. He enters the new world, the new old world, because could be Romania, could be Poland, could be Ukraine, could be. I mean, it's not that Romania is Romania because it's Romania. It's for the reasons we were talking about. But that posture is the posture in which you can be. You can experience and probably describe then in a novel a certain place, making people feel it, because what happens doesn't happen in the rational field, but happens with the senses. And so the Romania, the Bucharest that is in the book, it's so similar to many other freaking out zone that we all experience, or many other. I mean, when you are sad, the world around you looks sad, no? Now it's a word, contagium, that it's hard to use after the pandemic, but it's kind of a contagium. So if you are feeling a pain, the pain goes into the walls, into the buildings, into the trees, and that's the point of Lorenzo. He goes there with a mixture between looking for clues, being feeling sorrow, being surprised, curious, shocked. And this, the Romania and the city and the places he describes are basically his emotions becoming solid.
Well, I loved it. It's a great book. It's a great work of art. And I have to say, before I let you go, that in English, you are in the hands of a wonderful translator. And I want to give credit to the translator, who sometimes gets lost in the shuffle when works get translated. But her name is Elizabeth Harris, and I've read enough works in translation to know when one is really good. Like you, this is a beautiful translation into English.
Yeah, you know, Elizabeth Harris, to me, is kind of a genius. The one thing that I really love of her is that she has ear, and the writing is music. And she is kind of a jazz player, so she starts from the standard of the original writing, and then she plays her music that is complete, but is like jazz works. I mean, it's completely close to the standard, but it's her music, and so for me, I guess, yeah, the experience, and I realized that she was so great because. First, because I read her first sample, the first 15 pages the publisher sent me at the beginning. I thought, oh my God, that's great, because it's like singing, and my style in Italian is a very musical style. And if my books they lose, they miss the style, the music, I mean, they are completely lost. It's not that the story is enough, or I mean, you can say it's a beautiful story, but it's not the point. The point is, yeah, the senses we were talking about, you know. And Liz once wrote to me for a piece saying, so we talk to each other, and sometimes she has questions, and it's exactly from the questions that you understand if a translator is a good translator.
Right.
And for instance, she was saying, oh, you know, I would change this word into this. I would put this other word. I don't know if you agree, but I would do that because this creates an internal rhyme with the word you used three lines before. And since you have so many internal rhymes, I guess you have other internal rhymes, but if we add this in English, it creates the sound that you create in Italian. And this email, I don't even remember if I guess I accepted, but I remember the question, but I remember that I was amazed by someone who was talking about music. And so that's the point. She's a great a writer a translator has to be a great writer as well, and she's a great writer, and she can play her music, and because a book also in translation has to have a character, meaning a personality, a musical personality, and that's given by the translator. Then there's the imagery, there are the metaphors, there's the soul, the mood, and whatever it is. So there's lots. It's the iceberg is under the water, and it's probably the author. But this little thing that you see just looking at the sea, that's the translator, and this is Elizabeth Harris.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to talk about that, because I think sometimes it's overlooked. I need to have maybe a larger conversation with a translator at some point, because it's a very delicate art in its own right. And, you know, it's not just a matter of translating the words, like you say.
No.
You really, yeah, it's an art form, and you really have to, like,
you have
hone
to create
it.
A word. You have to create a new word,
yep,
that didn't exist and,
yep,
doesn't exist before you write. It exists in another language, but this means that it doesn't exist.
Well, you should stick with Elizabeth on future translations. I think she knows how to play,
yeah,
your songs.
Yeah. We like to play together.
Yeah. Well, it's great to meet you. I really enjoyed our conversation, and I guess a question would be, like, are you working on something new that would be available in translation in the North America or in English? Like, what's on your plate right now creatively?
Oh yeah, there is just a new novel just came out in Italy, and the title is Il Libro delle Case, meaning the Book of Homes, and it's basically the story of a man told through the houses he lived in different moments, going up and down in time and spaces, so from 75 all of a sudden to 2002 and then to 86 and so on. And this novel, it came out 1 month ago, or a little bit more. It's just been long listed for the Strega, Premio Strega, that is the most important Italian literary prize.
And so congratulations.
Thank you. And so I'm doing really, I'm running, I'm basically chased by myself. So I'm just trying to escape having lots of presentations online from the same place as I present this book, the one I was, the myself I was 13 years ago, and the one I am now. Translation will be available, but it's a longer book, and so you guys have to wait and to read and reread if you kept a record of seats. But another thing I'm doing, I just published a few days ago a little piece on LitHub, and so now I'm more writing narrative essays for America. So if you guys wait, you'll see me somewhere in a different mode, researching, experiencing different things. And so maybe you won't read about Romania, but about Louisiana, or about Texas, or about an Italian guy trying to not forget Italian after spending so much time trying to figure out how to survive in English.
Well, I wish you well on all of the above. Great to meet you. Congrats on this fine translation, and congrats on the new one, you know, that's been long listed as well.
It was great to meet you. Great.
Okay, guys, there you have it. That is Andrea Bajani. And his new novel is called If You Kept a Record of Sins, available now in English from Archipelago Books, a wonderful translation by Elizabeth Harris from the Italian. If You Kept a Record of Sins by Andrea Bajani, go get your copy immediately. Andrea Bajani, for those of you who aren't aware, is one of the foremost contemporary authors from Italy. In Italy, you know what I mean. If You Kept a Record of Sins won a slew of prizes, including the Supermondello Prize, the Brancati Prize, the Recanati Prize, and the Lo Straniero Prize, if I'm pronouncing those correctly. He's been translated in many languages, published by some of the better presses in Europe, and he now lives in Houston and teaches at Rice University. One more time, the book is called If You Kept a Record of Sins. I strongly recommend it. The Other People podcast is offered freely. Every single episode of this show, more than 700 episodes and counting, all of it is available to you, the listener, free of charge. It is a listener-supported show. If you like this program and you listen to it regularly and you get something from it, I hope you'll consider supporting the show. If you have the means, you can do that for as little as $1 a month. Tip your server. Throw a buck in the hat. Throw more if you have more. There are different tiers, different levels of support. There are prizes, bonuses. You know what I'm talking about. You can get a t-shirt, a tote bag, a sticker, a coffee mug, a book club subscription. I'll wish you happy birthday. I'll write you a handwritten postcard. Come on. Just go to patreon.com/otherpplpod. patreon.com/otherpplpod. Support the show. Show it some love at patreon.com/otherpplpod. If you would like to write to me, the email address is letters@otherppl.com. Don't forget that this show has its own official app. It, too, is free. The Other People with Brad Listy app. Go get it wherever you get your apps. What else? Coming up next, I think there's going to be a Sunday episode featuring Patricia Engel. Stay tuned for that. Other good ones in the pipeline. Appreciate you listening. We'll talk to you soon.